You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU. Today on the show, we'll be talking to Dr. Karis Massarella about issues in transgender healthcare, looking at education, access, and what can be improved. Dr. Massarella is president of the Medical Staff Association at St. Joseph's Hospital. She is also an assistant clinical professor in the emergency division at McMaster Medical School. She teaches transgender primary healthcare to students, residents, and family doctors.
All right, so thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Massarella.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
So to start off, maybe we can just talk a little bit about what it means to be transgendered and the difference between sex and gender so that our listeners can understand that a little bit better.
I think it's actually really important to differentiate between the two, because one of the big things that people do misunderstand about transgender people is that it's about sexuality. And in right. fact, it's although you can't necessarily split up sexuality and gender, they are separate. Mm-hmm. So somebody's sexuality, as we say in a trans community, is somebody who you're attracted to. Mm-hmm. So sort of what's between your legs, right?
Right.
And your gender identity is how you identify or what's in your brain. Mm-hmm. So a person who's transgender can also be transgender but identify as straight, queer, bisexual. So there's certainly, although you know sexuality and gender are linked, they are actually two separate issues or ideas.
Right. And so when a person identifies to be transgendered, can you just kind of give us an explanation of what that means and maybe the difference between being transgendered and what people used to refer to as transsexual and some of those definitions?
Sure. So, I mean, essentially, when we talk now about transgendered, we're talking about a whole community of people who feel that their gender identity is incongruent with their biologic assigned sex.
Right.
In the old days, sorry, we don't really use the term transsexual anymore, at least I don't, because I think it does confuse people as about gender identity and sexuality. Mm-hmm. So in the old days, a transsexual would have been described as somebody who went and actually had gender reassignment surgery and right. actually went actively sought gender reassignment. Whereas today we use transgender as an umbrella term to describe all people who feel that their gender identity doesn't match that of their biologically assigned sex. And that can be anybody from, you know, trans men, trans women, people who are genderqueer, people who are gender non-specific.
Right.
But still, for the most part, it does describe people who wish to alter their appearance to match their felt gender identity.
Right. And you just referred to the idea of gender as an umbrella term, transgender being an umbrella term. And I guess that kind of reminds me of sometimes when people talk about sexuality as a spectrum. Is that the same type of thing you would apply to mm-hmm. the idea of gender?
I mean, one of the things that our society has, it's, you know, the gender binary is very rigid. Mm-hmm. You can sort of be male or female, and you're slotted into one or the other from the moment you're born.
Right.
So as we know, the first thing parents often ask a physician is it a boy or a girl?
Right.
And, you know, if it's a girl, you get pink. If it's right. a boy, you get blue. So almost from the beginning, you're slotted into a gender. And of course, nobody asks a child if they're comfortable with that gender.
Right.
And, you know, initially, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was the same for sexuality. People were expected if you were a man, you were attracted to women, and if you were a female, you were attracted to men.
Right.
And obviously, we learned that sexuality can be quite diverse. And I think in the gender community, at least, we realize that gender can be equally as diverse. Mm-hmm. The differences in gender may not be as common as they are with sexuality, but they're certainly there.
Right. You were just talking about how maybe the differences in gender aren't as common as the differences in sexuality. Can you give us anything about sort of numbers, maybe even what people think in sort of the general population as opposed to what maybe the actual number of transgender people in the community are?
So one of the things that we don't have a good handle on is what is the incidence and prevalence of people who identify as transgendered.
Yeah.
Because some of the data, the original data that was done by the Dutch, only looked at people who had SRS or sexual reassignment surgery.
Right.
But we know, in fact, that the majority of transgender people actually don't even seek gender reassignment surgery. Mm-hmm. So when you look at data, it's really hard to say. But some of the most recent data would suggest that the number is somewhere between 1 in 1,500 and 1 in 3,000 people mm-hmm. Would identify as transgender.
Right.
So much, much higher than the original numbers. It would have suggested, you know, 20 or 30 years ago that, first of all, trans men didn't even exist.
Right.
And that trans women were 1 in 25 to 1 in 30,000.
Right.
So I think much more common than people realize.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. And maybe we were talking earlier before we started the program about maybe representations of gender in the media or yeah. in sort of celebrity culture. And yep. maybe you can just talk a little bit about that because I found that interesting.
So I think one of the things that people mistake is, you know, identity. Mm-hmm. And so we have lots of examples, particularly in entertainment media, people who been gender. You know, one of the classic examples that people don't often think about is Mick Jagger.
Right.
Mick Jagger, although considered a very, you know, strong, virile, heterosexual male, when he presents, he's very small and slight. He has big pouty lips. He wears very tight clothes,
right.
Very feminine-looking clothes. And so, in a sense, Mick Jagger presents as genderqueer.
Right.
Another example from the 1980s, for most of you med students, would probably be too long ago, but would be, you know, Boy George.
Right.
Certainly bent gender. And then even more modern today, we could think about somebody like Lady Gaga.
Right.
And all these folks play with gender. And sort of in the entertainment industry, that's sort of acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Step outside the entertainment industry, and it becomes weird.
Right. Yeah, another. And when you talk about playing with gender, can you talk a little bit about maybe what that means in childhood as well and how that can evolve over the years?
So I think that's a really important point. So gender variance play is very, very common in young children. We know that, for example, lots of young kids, particularly young boys, will dress up in their mother's clothes, will often, you know, put on mom's clothes, put on her high heels and clomp around, and everybody thinks it's really cute.
Right.
Now, as children get older, it becomes less cute. But what I find quite fascinating about gender is that for girls, there is the opportunity to explore gender more broadly.
Right.
Because there is the concept of the tomboy. And the tomboy is an opportunity for a young girl to take on a more masculine, you know, non-traditional female type role. And in fact, one could even almost argue that tomboy is now a traditional female role.
Right.
However, for the boy, there is no equivalent of a femme boy. Or, you know, a girly boy. In fact, if a boy presents as femme at an early age, it almost guarantees bullying, harassment, marginalization, and a trip to the psychiatrist by the parents to figure out what's wrong with their child.
Right. And I guess we'll talk a little bit more later about sort of the journey of maybe a transgender child into their adolescence. But like you said, it would usually involve a first trip to the psychiatrist. So maybe from there we can start talking a little bit about the pathologization and marginalization of the transgender community. So I just wonder if you can maybe comment on, just in general, the main barriers to healthcare that the transgender community faces.
Sure, I think that's an excellent question. Certainly, the trans community, just by statistics alone, is an exceptionally marginalized community. When you examine statistics, we know that trans people are more likely to be homeless, more likely to live in poverty, more likely to experience violence, more likely to do sex work, and more likely to lose their job or have fear of losing their job because of their identity. We also know that suicide rates in the trans population and attempted suicide rates can be up to 30 times higher than the general population.
Wow.
So it's quite stark. And these numbers are recent numbers. These aren't old numbers. These are two surveys that have been done in the last 2 years, the United States and Canada. So we do certainly know that gender and being transgender can certainly drive health determinants. One of the big problems I see in transgender healthcare is that the minute that somebody announces they're transgender, the healthcare provider's first visit is to the DSM-4, TR, to look up transgender. The minute you have a mental health diagnosis, you're on the path to marginalization.
Right.
And what I think disturbs me most about being transgendered is that for really being yourself and living in a state of being, you are defined as a pathology.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like if I looked at you, Matt, and you, you know, as a cisgendered heterosexual male, and said to you, you need to see a psychiatrist about that.
Right.
You'd be like,
it's not something that happens.
Right, it doesn't happen. But for a trans person, what it, to me, is just an identity that's part of the rich diversity of the human condition, you immediately get pathologized. And when you get pathologized, it means two things. One, it means that you get marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, particularly with mental health diagnosis, and number two, it means that people think they can cure you.
Right.
And when I say cure you, I mean you will stop being transgendered, get a grip, and realize you're a boy or a girl. When I, you know, and I think that is unfortunate.
Yeah. And I mean, can you also talk a little bit even about how the experience of maybe a transgendered person when they go to maybe a community ER or a community family physician and how that might differ from somebody that's cisgendered?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. One of the biggest problems that we have with transgender people is gender markers.
Right.
So, for example, what is really, I think, the most horrifying thing for trans people, and this happens in this province, is that in order to get your gender markers changed, so in order to have a female health card in Ontario, you have to essentially be sterilized.
Right.
In order for you to have your health card changed from male to female in the province of Ontario, you're supposed to have gender reassignment surgery, which is effective sterilization of individuals.
Yeah.
So what happens is often clients who are pre-op, when they go to the emergency department, and they may either pass well or not pass well. The minute the nurse will see the health card, and I've experienced this in the past, they'll say, oh, I think there's something wrong with your health card if you pass well. And if you don't pass well, then they'll start mispronouncing you and misgendering you. And there's nothing more humiliating to a trans person who is doing their best to present in their preferred gender to be called he or sir or ma'am, when they clearly, by their gender presentation and their gender identity, prefer to be called by the appropriate gender markers. And I think that's really hurtful. In fact, it's shown in data that up to 50% of trans people did not seek healthcare when they felt they had an emergency because of the way they're treated in emergency departments.
Right, which is a pretty startling statistic, really.
It's a horrifying statistic.
And you were alluding just now to the idea of passing. And maybe can you talk just a little bit more about that and some of the things you're talking about maybe shame or the feeling of not belonging when somebody isn't identifying or isn't able to pass as well as they like, is the gender they identify as?
So passing is a very, very big issue, particularly for trans women. Most trans males, and this is just a fact, will pass if they're on testosterone. Because again, you can still have that sort of masculine female look, which is acceptable in our society.
Right.
Again, there's no equivalent acceptable, feminine male look. Mm-hmm. And so in such a binary divided society, if somebody appears incongruent to how you feel they should look, then often they get harassed. And so it's a bit of a controversial topic in the trans community about passing. A lot of trans people will say, well, why do you have to pass? You should just be yourself, which I accept that argument. But then as a physician who sees real-life trans people and hears their experiences, the problem for a lot of trans people, they don't pass, is their lives are difficult. They get misgendered, they get threatened, they get hurt. And these are real issues. And so for a transgendered person, to pass means that life is easier. It means, so for example, if you were to look at myself, mm-hmm. I think that most people would have no idea that I was transgendered.
Right.
Unless I chose to disclose that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm disclosing that now.
Right.
However, so I can choose to be a trans activist or a trans person when I want to be. But a lot of my community members don't have that choice. And I think one of the things that I believe passing makes your life easier, but I wish we had a society where passing wasn't that important.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And I think it's probably hard for a lot of people that are cisgendered and have never had to deal with those feelings of marginalization to really think about what that could feel like. I think we're just going to take a really quick break right now. This has been fantastic so far. And when we come back, we're going to continue to talk a little bit more with Dr. Massarella. So we hope you stick with us. so we're back with Dr. Massarella of St. Joseph's Healthcare, who was talking to us a little bit about today, kind of just the tip of the iceberg about issues in transgender healthcare in Canada. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about this concept of passing and the experience of a transgendered person when they go to seek healthcare right now from our Canadian system. And I guess as embarrassing as it is that a lot of people in the healthcare field or entering healthcare wouldn't know how to, you know, properly approach a person who is transgendered, I was hoping that maybe you could give us just a little bit of sort of a trans patient 101 in terms of things like pronouns and acceptance and just, you know.
Well, certainly, you know, in your office, in your emergency department, wherever you work, clinic, your hospital, I think, you know, it behooves all hospitals to have a trans-friendly environment. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, first of all, using the proper terms is important.
Yeah.
So respectful terms for trans people would include being transgendered. Also for a trans man, who is somebody who's female to male, trans man is a respectful term, trans male is a respectful term.
Okay.
For a trans woman, so a male to female, then trans woman or trans female are respectful terms.
Yeah.
And what you should ask the client, regardless of what's on their health card or driver's license information, is what name they'd like to be, you know, go by, and what pronouns you'd like them to use. And ask them. I mean, most trans people aren't offended by that. And if they are, they're probably a bit sensitive because they've, you know, they've...
had some negative treatment
or experiences. Exactly, some very negative experience in the past. But work your way through that and just say, you know what, I'm an ally. I just want to know how I can do this so that, you know, we're respectful of you.
Right.
So I would certainly recommend that that's what you do.
Okay.
On your medical record, you should have... You know, obviously, at some point, you may say biologic male, biologic female. But you can also say that they're transgendered and their preferred name. And I think those are things that you should do. And I think if you just, even those simple things make a huge difference, because at least it indicates that you have some respect for that person's identity and you respect their journey.
Right. No, that's really good to know. And so now if you were, say, an MP and you were allowed to grant one bill automatically and make one change to the Canadian healthcare system as it is right now, what would be the first thing that you would do in a way to, you know, positively affect the health of trans people living in Canada right now?
Can I say two things?
You can say two things, sure.
Well, the first thing I would say is that most people don't realize that gender identity is not a protected human right in this country. Wow. There's only one province or territory where there is protection for gender, and it's the Northwest Territories.
It's not a protected human right.
It is not a protected human right.
Wow.
There was a bill in the last parliament called Bill C-389, which actually was intended to provide... gender identity as a protected human right under the Canadian Human Rights Act. And it actually was passed by Parliament.
Okay.
And it got support from all parties, including the Conservative Party, including four cabinet ministers in the Conservative Party, which may come as a surprise to
which
people
is some
here.
Progress, at least. That yes. It happened.
But unfortunately, with the calling of the election, any bill that hasn't had royal assent to the Senate dies. So unfortunately, it has to be reintroduced to Parliament. So I think one of the most important things is, first of all, to recognize gender identity as a protected human right. In terms of healthcare specifically, transgender transition is expensive.
Okay.
It's just a fact of life. It's expensive.
Can you give us some numbers on that?
For a trans woman, probably the average cost is somewhere between $75,000 to $100,000 out of pocket. And you're talking about marginalized people who can barely put food on their table.
Right. It's people that are living below the poverty line as it is being asked to hand over $75,000 to $100,000.
Exactly.
So that they can feel like the identity that they identify with.
Exactly. And you look at a trans male and you're talking maybe, again, depending on what surgery they have, if it includes phalloplasty, then you're looking at a similar price point. So what I would like to see is surgery covered for trans people.
Right.
Currently in Ontario, they do cover gender reassignment surgery, so genital surgery.
Okay.
And they cover top surgery or chest surgery for males. However, the irony of the chest surgery is that it's mastectomy.
Right, so the full removal of the breast tissue?
Exactly, including nipple. Whereas every trans male I know wants chest contour surgery with preservation of their nipples. Otherwise, they kind of just look like a Ken doll.
Right.
Yeah. Which is not realistic. So... really, other surgeries that would include phalloplasty, hysterectomy, facial masculinization surgery, facial feminization surgery, breast implants, which unfortunately are considered cosmetic by the Ontario government.
So therefore, even if it's like a medical reason, they're still considered cosmetic?
Correct.
Okay.
So it's considered cosmetic surgery. We have been trying to negotiate with the government, with the OHIP, regarding that, but right now there's absolutely no give, and particularly in these difficult financial times, there's definitely no give. let's put it this way, we're not a hot political
item. Yeah, you're not the top lobbying party right now.
No, we don't have a lot of political clout. Nobody's worrying about the transgender vote when they're
running for parliament.
Yeah, when they're running for parliament, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And I know you have a lot of opinions about sort of the status of LGBTQ education in the realm of medical education, be it for future physicians, nurses, social workers. Can you maybe talk a little bit more about the changes you'd like to see in medical education?
Well, currently, recently there was an article in JAMA which looked at medical schools in North America and the amount of time that they devoted to LGBTQ care. And across all the medical schools in North America who responded, which was the majority,
right,
it's less than 5 hours on average.
Which, 5 hours?
5 hours.
Over the entire course of training.
Over the entire course of training. And I'm sure you learn more about some very rare, unusual neurologic conditions that you'll never see than you do about something that you're most likely to see in your practice.
Right, on a fairly regular basis.
On a fairly regular basis. So, I mean, I strongly believe that we should be doing more LGBTQ education. And here at McMaster, we didn't really do much. It has changed recently because now I sort of do the pro comp now. But
right.
In reality, there's not much teaching here either.
Wow.
And I think you guys should advocate for that change.
Yeah, it's funny because today we had our session on palliative care, and apparently 8 years ago there was only 5 hours of palliative care as well. So it's,
yeah. End
it's,
of life.
And what death. Were we learning? What was in the curriculum?
Well, you're learning about all these, you know, unusually rare diseases that, you know, that all these specialists have interests in, which, of course, aren't right. germane to your real-life practice.
Yeah, but it's often the social aspects of medicine that seem to kind of get left out or shifted to the side.
There's absolutely no question that I agree with that, yes.
Yeah. So going from there, we were talking a little bit about education and maybe what the role of a physician might be to a transgendered person. And that leads itself sort of to this idea of passing and transitioning. So mm-hmm. can you maybe tell us the typical journey of an adolescent that is identifying as transgendered and the steps they might take in order to transition?
Sure. I think in an ideal world, which is what I'm trying to work
towards. We're trying to get
right.
there.
Is that, you know, first of all, and it's happening more frequently, people will come out as transgendered at a younger age. So what you, as I talked about before, gender variant play in children is quite common.
Mm-hmm.
The children we tend to see at a young age are children who are very persistently gender variant, who want to go to school as girls or boys, opposite to their biologic gender. And of course, that does cause a lot of angst in parents, teachers, social mm-hmm. workers, other folks. And so what we try and tell people is relax. You know, let your child guide you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, social transition isn't the worst thing in the world. I would argue that if you take a six-year-old boy or girl, or a six-year-old boy, grow their hair long and put them in a dress, I guarantee you, unless you see them naked, you would not know that was a boy.
No, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, I think people need to chill out about clothing and appearance.
Yeah.
But people don't. That's a fact of our society. Once you get to about 9 or 10, you have a child that's persistently gender variant, then you probably have a trans kid. And you have to remember that most very young gender variant children will not actually be trans. Most of those children will be gay or lesbian.
Okay.
Okay. However, once they're 10, 11, getting towards puberty adolescence, and they're still persistently gender variant, then you probably have a trans kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, you should have options. So with the support of the family, the ideal situation is to let that child enter the very beginning of puberty, which is a Tanner 2 stage.
Okay.
And then what you would do is you put them on hormone blockers.
Okay.
Which is typically Lupron.
Which would sort of halt the right. process of puberty.
And this gives the child and the parents a chance to explore their gender. At that time, when the child reaches the age of 16, which is essentially the age of consent, if the child still wants to pursue gender transition, then we would start the child on hormones. So estrogen for biologically male children and testosterone for biologically female children.
Okay.
This would then lead to the secondary sexual characteristics of the preferred gender as opposed to their nascent gender. What's great about this is, first of all, you have usually a very happy child.
Yeah.
And usually have a very happy family.
Yeah.
Ultimately. Sometimes it takes a bit of work with the parents to get them to understand that this is going to make their child happy.
Right.
And then other things too. Usually it requires less surgery. So usually the breast growth in trans females is adequate. Usually you don't have to have facial feminization surgery.
If you start the hormones at a young enough
yes.
age. Okay.
The only concern is, and this is a legitimate concern, is that because when they're on blockers, you don't get adequate penile growth, that sometimes you have to do a more invasive genital reassignment surgery. But I think if you ask most trans kids, they would be...
What they would prefer.
They would be fine with that, yes.
Okay.
Because one of the worst things for trans youth, and I can tell you by personal experience, is puberty.
Right.
puberty is a horrible experience for a transgender child.
It's horrible for everybody, so I can only imagine how much worse how much worse it must be.
So you're feeling awkward about being going through puberty, but also feeling awkward about being in the wrong gender at puberty. So it's almost like, you know, the higher power is playing a joke on you.
Right.
So it's quite awful.
Totally. And now, for a young person that's going through this, or even an older person that's already through puberty but looking to transition, where do you go? Who do you talk to? Who do you seek out for these resources?
It's a great question. So until recently, that had been a huge problem in the province of Ontario. Initially, the only people that had a gender clinic was at CAMH, which was sort of the traditional psychiatric pathologization of trans people.
Right, here's your diagnosis.
Right, and now we're going to make sure you're trans, and if you're lucky, we might give you hormones.
Okay.
Now, and oh, by the way, before we give you hormones, you have to live in your preferred gender for a year.
Okay.
Yeah, without hormones, because that'll work. You know?
Right. Yeah, nobody will notice, right?
Hairy beast
of
a man wearing a dress. No problem there.
Yeah, in terms of passing, that sounds like a really reasonable...
Totally safe. No violence, no violence or worry there.
No.
So, today, you know, there are options. So, in Ontario, if you live in Toronto, there's Sherburn Health Center. Mind you, they have a two-year waiting list now. There's St. Michael's Family Emerge Group, a family health group, sorry. And then outside of Toronto, there's me.
Right. And you're working at an organization called Quest, which is in St. Catharines.
Correct.
Maybe you can tell us a little more about
that. So I do a Tuesday clinic at Quest Community Health Center in St. Catharines. And essentially, it's a transgender care clinic where I help manage trans clients. You don't have to see a psychiatrist to see me.
It's just direct primary care.
Just direct primary care. And what I will do is I'll put them through something called the Sherburn Protocol, which you can download from the Sherburn Health Center website. And it basically is a really an ABC approach to transgender care. And when I say that anybody can do it, I really mean anybody can do it.
Right. So, I mean, it would be a goal that rather than having to seek out these really specialized, specific locations right now to for people to have help with transitioning, maybe in the future any primary care physician or nurse practitioner would be able to help a client undergo the process of transitioning.
Well, as I see, my goal is to put myself out of business.
Right.
However, I think, you know, there's always going to be some need for some expert opinion about trans folks and for help for people who don't do a lot of it. And so hopefully, you know, I can still fulfill that role into the future. But, you know, currently, you know, my goal is just to try and advocate for transgender healthcare, to advocate for my community. And I think to teach the next generation of physicians that this isn't a psychiatric diagnosis. Don't pathologize trans people. Help them through medical transition. And it can be one of the most rewarding experiences of your career because you take somebody who will be so grateful and so happy. I mean, every day I work, I get hugs from patients. And not that I need hugs, because I mean, I have other people who hug me as well. But you say, you know, thank you. You know, thank you so much. You helped save my life. You helped make my dream come true. I mean, you don't get that a lot in medicine.
No.
Nobody says, thank you. You helped. For giving me insulin, you helped make my dream come true.
No, it's just thank you for putting in that Foley.
Right, exactly. So it's actually a really rewarding experience for physicians. And I can only encourage all of you to get interested and help out.
Yeah, well, I think that was a really positive message for us to actually end off with. We're out of time now, but just thank you so much for spending the time to talk with us, Dr. Massarella. I think it was really enlightening for me, and I think it'll be very enlightening for all our listeners as well. And hopefully as a community, we can come together and try to continue the positive change for the transgender community, at least in terms of healthcare.
Anyways, my pleasure, Matt, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak.
No problem.
Thanks for listening to Health Justice Radio Collective. For more information on this and past episodes, check out our website at healthjusticeradio.com.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.